This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Peter Berkowitz of the Hoover Institution, writing most recently of the disorder that we see in the land, cultural disorder, driven by a glossary that is fresh. The glossary has to do with identity politics. However, in reading Peter's essay, and we will go back to the French Revolution eventually, I was reminded of the disorder that I lived through as a young person on university campus. And Peter, I want to make certain that I have the right direction. My learning these days is that the language of disorder that is now being practiced culturally throughout the land, between the red and blue states, between the nationalists and the globalists, between the old and the young, certainly between the identity politics and the politics of the Constitution, all of that is language that has been developed these last years on the university campus. Is that generally true, Peter? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Yes, it's generally true, and even more, it's true in even a stronger way than you suggested. Of course, trigger warnings and safe zones and intersectionality and institutional racism and systemic racism and critical race theory, all of these are terms that have entered the general vocabulary in the last few years. But these terms have been developed and many others over the course of many, many decades by now on the universities.
On the university campus. So I go to, I was a member of the Daily Princetonian when I was a lad, Peter. And I go to a quote that is appears in the Daily Princetonian Monday, February 3rd, 1969. In other words, the Great Society has just stepped down from the world stage. Lyndon Johnson has retired. And at this point, what you'd have to say is that his Great Society is retired. Lyndon Johnson has finally retired. He's left us. However, Richard Nixon is now the president of the United States. And Vietnam War dominates the conversation on campus. And we have this quote from February 3rd from S.I. Hayakawa, acting president of San Francisco State College, on why university teachers back student revolts. Said President Hayakawa, if you want to spit in the eye of the establishment, you are praised for it. You are told you are a bright boy. End quote. Peter, is that generality suitable for what we see now on university campuses? The idea that iconoclasm is celebrated as progressive and benighted, and that the idea of resisting that kind of confrontation is seen as repressive and old-fashioned?
Well, the answer is yes and no. In other words, what we're seeing on campus today is certainly the descendant of the spirit of the 1960s, that is, spit on the establishment, or we could even say more, demand freedom of speech in order to express yourself by denouncing the establishment. But a very interesting transformation has taken place over the last several decades. Nobody speaks today, for some reason, of the establishment with a capital E. Why is that? Because the people who used to be the establishment, namely the professors and the administrators, they are now the ones they are participating in this spitting, which is not so much on the establishment as it is on the history of the United States and what the United States stands for. And when we witness the stifling of speech on campus, which we do in a variety of ways, in my judgment at least, this is not a break with the spirit of the 1960s, even though then the students demanded free speech. It's a kind of culmination, because now that progressive sensibility having so deeply rooted itself on the campuses, today's students and faculty and administration don't want to permit any alternative point of view to interfere with the hegemony of this progressive outlook.
Let's go to a recent incident, although I have many more headlines from 1969, but a recent incident on Yale campus when the president of Yale, a very powerful individual in the establishment of university life, I use the word advisory.
Yes.
Right. responded to a brouhaha over Halloween. Peter, I want you to tell the story because it's very difficult to take seriously unless I understand the underlying themes. What about Halloween required the president of Yale to get involved in a policing fashion?
Well, it is a rather remarkable story. In the early autumn of 2015, a Yale official who is the number two person at one of Yale's residential houses, dormitories, published an open letter to the students saying that she believed, contrary to a position that apparently some students held and the university held, it was her belief that students should be allowed, indeed have the responsibility, for managing their own Halloween parties. The question was, what if one of the students wears a Halloween costume that's in bad taste or that offends another student's sensibilities? And this professor, Professor Christakis, said, well, in the case that one of your fellow students wears a costume that offends your sensibility, you have a couple of options. You can ignore it, or you can explain to your fellow student why you believe that his or her costume is inappropriate, is insensitive. This letter to the students, which in my eyes, by a reasonable measure, was giving students credit, treating them as adults, was met with outrage by at least some students, and a vocal minority of students denounced Christakis and denounced the very idea that students could manage their own Halloween parties. In response to the brouhaha, President of Yale University, Peter Salovey, pledged tens of millions of dollars to establish new consciousness-raising sessions to make administrators and faculty members more racially sensitive. And he underscored that racial sensitivity training will begin with he himself, the president of Yale University. This after, as you know, decades of Yale spending millions upon millions of dollars promoting equality on campus.
So the president of Yale took charge of this as a leader of the reforms. I want to compare that or contrast that, or just to say that we're exploring ironies here. This is the Daily Princetonian, Friday, April 11th, 1969. The headline, 400 cops crush Harvard liberation, in quotes. 400 police marched through the cold gray Cambridge dawn into Harvard Yard yesterday, crushing the liberation of University Hall, arresting 197 and injuring about 30 demonstrators. Stunned by the police action, 1,500 students gathered later and called for a student strike through Monday and the resignation of Harvard's president if he failed to meet their demands. At 4 a.m. yesterday, the 250 students who occupied the main Harvard administration building awoke to the sound of police organizing on Massachusetts Avenue. Peter, the puzzle here is, 50 years ago, the president of Harvard was seen as the villain, as the enemy, as the adversary, almost as if he lived in Hanoi. I only exaggerate a little bit, only a little bit. You're quite familiar with the terms of living in Harvard Yard. I am not. I have only spent time at Princeton, and it would have been the same there if the police came in. The protests would have been in 1969. The protests would have been directed against Bob Goheen and his residents. So what has changed in 50 years, Peter, is that the president of Harvard and the president of Yale and the president of Princeton appear to have crossed the barrier to stand with the students. Is that a fair measure of where we are?
It is a fair measure of where we are, but and we have to, I think, add, in order to understand it, add the following observation. In one sense, the president, the administration, has crossed the barrier and stands on the other side. But in another sense, they haven't crossed the barrier at all, because, after all, many of the current presidents and deans and provosts and so on belong to that very same generation of students who were rampaging in the late 60s and early 1970s. So those people haven't flipped sides. It's just that having grown up, they remained on the same side they were on as students.
That is an observation I have seen in many versions over the time, that the radicalization of the university campus started with my generation, the boomers, in the late 60s and early 70s and was reproduced because of the nature of university politics, the nature of being in a department. Now, Peter, you teach. You know universities. I do not. I just read about them in romantic tales. Is it possible that you can reproduce the radical politics of when you had all of your hair in 1969 and pass that on to subsequent generations of associate professors?
Well, I should make clear that although my principal paycheck comes from a great university, I don't spend most of my time on campus. However, I can say that in the logic of the circumstances of universities, yes, it's quite possible through the remarkable institution of tenure, whereby professors who are in place can ensure that the next generation of professors will march not to the beat of a different drummer, but will march to the beat of the current generation's sensibility. Now, there was a big break between the professors of the 60s and 70s and later generations of professors. The professors who were in power, who were senior professors in the 60s and 70s, were, to a significant extent, liberal in the old-fashioned sense and generous. And they opened up the ranks to the students coming up to graduate school in the 70s. But many of the graduate students coming up in the 70s brought a new sensibility to the university. And that sensibility was essentially Clausewitz applied to the academic world. In other words, education and scholarship are politics by other means. And that sensibility, I believe it's fair to say, has become deeply entrenched in our universities.
I'm speaking with Peter Berkowitz, writing at Real Clear Politics. Peter's at the Hoover Institution, and we're reflecting on my youth. Peter's being extremely tolerant of me, my youth. And when we come back, we're going to continue, because Peter can take us to the 18th century, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's social contract. I want to mention a university lecture I attended in my senior year by Herbert Marcuse, where I was told, this is the new left, and I had not a moment of understanding of what I heard. Peter's going to help me now, 50-plus years later. This is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBSI on the World with John Batchelor.